The United States Holocaust Museum opened in 1993 as a living memorial that inspires citizens and leaders worldwide to confront hatred, prevent genocide, and promote human dignity. Exhibits regularly raise provocative and painful questions, and the new installation, What Did Americans Know, is no exception. Joining me right now is guest curator Daniel Green. Dr. Green, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me.
How did you go about putting this exhibit together? I can't even imagine, but I'm interested in hearing your answer.
A large team at the Holocaust Memorial Museum has been working on Americans and the Holocaust for nearly 5 years now. And we wanted to take a very comprehensive approach to our research and to looking at American society. So we looked at all aspects of American society, obviously the U.S. government, but also asking questions like, how did popular culture respond to the threat of Nazism? How did the American media respond? How did faith leaders respond? And how did average Americans respond? So it was, I think it's safe to say this is the most comprehensive research project into this topic that's been attempted, certainly by a museum and maybe ever. And it was not just me. It was a large team of researchers at the Holocaust Memorial Museum.
Describe, if you will, what visitors to this exhibit will experience.
Well, visitors to the exhibit will see a lot about what America looked like in the 1930s and 40s. It's 80 years ago, so there's some living witnesses, but for many of our visitors, high school and college students, it may seem like ancient history. And what we wanted to show was how the context of the United States at the time shaped responses to Nazism. And what I mean by that context is Americans' isolationism from world affairs in the aftermath of World War I, the xenophobia, racism, and anti-Semitism that characterized American society during the 30s and 40s, and then especially the Great Depression, which weighed so heavily over the United States in the 1930s, and then, of course, the war in the 1940s. One of the things we really wanted visitors to understand is that Americans had access to a lot of information about Nazi Germany, including the persecution and murder of Europe's Jews as it was going on. And we want to raise tough questions at the museum. And so the tough question is, if we had this information, why didn't rescue of Jews become a priority?
Well, as we look at the surge in anti-Semitism across parts of the globe today, without being hyperbolic, I want to ask you, at what stage did some Americans step up to challenge the course of events during those pre-Holocaust years? What did it take for people to wake up?
Well, some stood up right away. When Hitler takes power in January of 1933, the American media and the American people are interested. We see this democracy crumble in Germany, and we see a new world leader. And so you see Hitler on the cover of very popular magazines. And actually what you see is faith leaders, Jewish and others, take to the streets in the spring of 1933. There are rallies across many northern cities, anti-Nazi rallies. There are protests. There are movements to boycott German-made goods. One of the questions that really hounded me throughout this process is, when does a protest become a mass movement? We see a lot of protest of Nazism, but we don't see, I think, a sustained anti-Nazi movement in the United States in the 1930s. And I think that's in large part because of the crisis of the Great Depression at home. If you don't have a job and you can't feed your children, that's what's on your mind every day. But you do see at times, especially faith leaders, stand up against Nazism. Later on in this history, here I'm talking about the late 1930s, early 1940s, when Americans really realize there's a refugee crisis, you do see some Americans take risks, financial risks, other types of risks, to aid refugees. But they're the ones going against the grain. They're not the mainstream. And I also wondered, why do these people do this? why make sacrifices to aid strangers, to aid refugees? And with faith leaders, whether it's Quakers or Mennonites or Unitarians and others, they'll point to a religious basis for their actions. But some others just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, you do this because it's the right thing to do, but it's not the mainstream.
Well, is it correct to say that most people here never became engaged in resistance?
I think it is correct. I think that you're right. Most people did not become engaged in resistance, but historians have sometimes used the explanation of, well, we just didn't know what was going on. And to me, that's an excuse, and it's an excuse that's not sustainable or provable. We actually, many Americans did know what's going on. One way you see this, a fascinating way you see this, is through public opinion polls in the United States. Gallup is asking Americans in 1938, do you disapprove of the Nazis' treatment of Jews? And the vast majority, 94% of Americans, say yes, they disapprove. Later on, Gallup is asking Americans whether they believe that mass murder is occurring in 1943-44. And you see an uptick over time. Americans do believe it. So it's not that we don't have information, and it's not that we don't know what's going on. So the haunting question is, why doesn't disapproval lead to action on behalf of the victims?
Well, this is the second time that question has come up, so let's go ahead. Tell us what you think the answer to that is.
I think sometimes individuals feel powerless, so they may realize that something terrible is going on, but not know how to respond. They might feel that an individual can't make a difference, and it's the mission of our museum, actually, to show that individuals can make a difference. So actually, when visitors walk into, even outside the gallery for the exhibition Americans and the Holocaust, they're confronted with two questions. One is, what did Americans know? And that's what I've been talking about here. And the other is, what more could have been done? And that's a harder question to get at, but we get at it by showing examples of people who took risks to rescue refugees or tried to pressure the U.S. government to do more to aid refugees. So it's through those counterexamples of people who went against the grain that we try to encourage people not to feel powerless in the face of atrocities.
Daniel, I have no intention to be hyperbolic, as I said before, but there has to be a way that we can talk about what that era and the present day have in common. Or by definition, we can't learn from history if we can't contextualize it. So what are some of the parallels?
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. And the exhibition is a history exhibition about the 1930s and 40s. The museum believes in the value of studying history. But of course, there are resonances today. And, you know, when the museum opened 25 years ago, Elie Wiesel, who was our founding chairperson, stood on the plaza outside the museum and he said, "This museum is not an answer, it's a question mark." And I think about that a lot, and the team thought about that a lot. What are the difficult questions that we wanted to raise? And so here, some of the difficult questions are, how do Americans debate their responsibilities to refugees? When we learn that a population is targeted for murder in a genocide, how do we debate our responsibilities to respond? Even with World War II, I think many visitors don't realize the depths of American isolationism in the 30s and 40s. When Europe goes to war in 39, right away, 90% of Americans say, we want to stay out. So also, how do we debate our responsibility to enter a war that many Americans consider a foreign war? We want to raise these tough questions. We don't want to put a neat bow on this history and wrap everything in a package that's always palatable and saying this is the answer. We actually feel like people should struggle with this history, but many of these questions are being asked today, and they can be asked in a more educated way and a more informed way by understanding that it's not the first time that Americans have faced these questions.
Yeah. I'm really curious about whether or not, as this exhibition gets attention, if you're going to hear any people saying, well, this really shouldn't be done because it makes us look bad, and we're trying to make America great again, and so why are you doing this to us?
Yeah, that's we never thought about it that way at the museum. It's not a finger wagging exhibition. Much more an exhibition about showing that Americans had much more information than many people assume about the threat of Nazism, showing the great sacrifices that millions of Americans made in World War II to defeat Nazism. That is central to the exhibition. Of over 400,000 Americans lost their lives fighting in World War II, and 16 million Americans served. But then millions more at home made sacrifices to defeat Nazism. So our country is mobilized to fight this fascist threat. Some people may say it mobilizes too slowly, but ultimately you do see it mobilized. And it's one of the, as President Roosevelt said, he called it the most tremendous undertaking in our American history. We want to honor that undertaking, but also ask why within that war humanitarian aims or rescue of the victims never became a priority.
Yeah. Thankfully, there's been a lot of interfaith cooperation in the past couple of years, particularly in terms of Muslim and Jewish communities in different cities standing together against bigotry and hate. Talk for a moment about how important these kinds of initiatives are, if you would.
They're critically important. The Holocaust Museum is not a museum solely for Jewish visitors. In fact, more than 90% of the people who come through the museum are not Jewish. It's important for all people to understand the potential worst outcomes of prejudice, hate, and bigotry. And the Holocaust is a terrible example of those potential outcomes. You know, there's a great story in the exhibition that I think of often, too, of a small community in Southbury, Connecticut, where the German-American Bund, Nazi sympathizers, wanted to set up a Hitler Youth-style summer camp. And it's the Congregationalist minister in that community at the South Britain Congregationalist Church in Connecticut who rallies faith leaders in Connecticut to say, we can't have a Nazi camp in our backyard. And he gives this very stirring sermon. His name is Reverend Lindsay, Edgar Lindsay. And he gives a very stirring sermon, Thanksgiving weekend of 1937, where he says, we need to keep the Nazis out because Nazis are unchristian and un-American. He's really looking at the fascist threat to American Christianity and to American values writ large. And he is, you do see interfaith efforts to mobilize against Nazism. Again, they're not the mainstream. They don't lead to a sustained anti-Nazi mass movement, but they're critically important, and Lindsay's effort is successful at the Nazi sympathizers abandon their hope to set up a summer camp in Southbury. So these local stories of what's possible with interfaith cooperation, we hope will inspire some of our visitors as well.
Daniel, what else should listeners know about this exhibit at the museum, including how long it will be on display?
The exhibition just opened, and it will be open for 3.5 years, so through the autumn of 2021. So visitors have a lot of time to get there. But for visitors who don't have time to get to Washington, D.C., there is a web version of the exhibition on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum site, so people can just search for Americans on the Holocaust under the museum's webpage.
I'm just at the end of our time, but I've got to ask you the question, what did working on this project do to you?
I've studied American response to the Holocaust now for more than 20 years. I think the thing that surprised me most was the depth of information that Americans had. But I think the thing that I try to honor most is the fact that these are the last moments to talk to living witnesses of this history. Not only Holocaust survivors, but American veterans who encountered concentration camps. And that is such a privilege that I think that we have at this moment that I know that my children will have to a lesser extent and my grandchildren won't have. And I feel that that's, we're at a critical moment in trying to preserve memory through living witnesses as well. And I thought about that a lot along the way.
Yeah. Historian Daniel Green is guest curator of Americans and the Holocaust, an exhibition at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Dr. Green is adjunct professor, Department of History, Northwestern University. The United States Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. is open to the public daily, and admission is free. Dr. Green, I'm really glad we got to talk because it's so good to hear what you have done and this exhibit that can make a real contribution, not just in understanding the past, but also in looking at where we are in the present. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your interest in the museum's work.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.